From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dreitzer from New York and Mark Sloboda from Moscow. Eric Dreitzer, Mark Sloboda, welcome back. Pleasure.
Don, thank you.
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, so there's a lot to talk about. I guess we could start with Portugal and Portugal's idea of democracy.
I don't know if it, I don't know if the question at issue is Portugal's idea of democracy or if it's the European Union's idea of democracy or lack thereof, because of course the news that you're referring to there, Don, is the fact that the left coalition, the socialists and their coalition partners in Portugal, have won an absolute majority in the recent elections, and the right-wing pro-austerity pro-EU government has basically said that they refuse to recognize the election. They refuse to recognize the left coalition's right and ability to form a new government in the parliament. And it's almost gone completely unnoticed, I would say. I mean, it's been reported on, of course, but it's not a major story. It's certainly in the back pages of the papers with what's happening with the hurricane in Mexico, with what's happening in Syria and elsewhere in the world. But it is a very interesting story. It is a very interesting development, because I think that probably the three of us here would have already known this for a long time, but to many people, they still labor under the delusion that the European Union is some kind of a democratic union, an institution that values democracy, when in fact, I think that what's happened in Portugal clearly and unmistakably illustrates quite the opposite, that rather than being interested in democracy, the European Union seems to be essentially a financial and political dictatorship run by the bankers in Germany, in Brussels, and to a lesser extent in some of the other capitals. And I think that what's interesting about this, too, is seeing it in the context of what happened in Greece.
Let me just point something out for the audience, and this bears on it. The actual agency that's being used to block the majority group that in the parliament from governing is the usually ministerial president. This is not a strong president government system. This is he's a ceremonial, and it's a prime minister that's the strong person in that. And the conservative, the guy whose party is in the minority now, he is stopping the majority from governing based on, whatever, on his arguments.
Whose party just got only 28%.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's
so
correct.
He's saying essentially that the threat of causing financial catastrophe by doing what the people elected a parliament to do is not something that can be tolerated under their democratic system. That's more or less a
right.
quote.
And what I was gonna get to is the fact that essentially the pretext under which this president is, maybe not formally but informally, nullifying the results of this election is the fact that it would create financial chaos and conflict with the European Union under their fiscal agreements and under the EU's financial arrangements. And basically, the scapegoat here, or the sort of the negative example, is Greece. That Portugal is basically, or this president in Portugal is basically saying that they don't want to allow a Syriza-style government to come to power that will then challenge the establishment in the EU. Now, I'll get to my lack of faith in their ability to do that in a second.
And also, go to this also. I'd like to hear a comparative analysis between the referendum that Syriza took into the negotiating room in its pocket, looking at what happened later in the context of that and the response from the powers that be, and what's happening in Portugal, and comparing those as models.
Well, exactly, and essentially what you're seeing in Portugal is a popular sentiment against not just austerity. I think that is only part of it. This is against the financial dictatorship known as the EU. It is against the established forces that control the European Union, and it is against a lot of the draconian measures that have been put in place. And when we say that this is a left coalition, it's not simply one that's controlled by the traditional left parties, although, of course, course, they're the sort of the symbolic leaders of this. But I mean, you've had major labor unrest in Portugal for a number of years now. Teachers, nurses, transport workers, sanitation workers, many others who have gone out on strikes repeatedly against cuts to their wages, against cuts to the social safety net, against all of the traditional raft of austerity measures that we've seen over and over again play out in a number of countries in Europe. And so this is the grassroots that was essentially mobilized and that was voting in this election, and the results are unmistakable. The pro-austerity parties were absolutely trounced at the polls, and now they are refusing to recognize what's the results of the election. And just as you were getting at, Don, and I want to get Mark's take on this as well, the example of Greece, not just a referendum, but just the course of the development from Syriza's election in January through what I would I call, probably without argument here, Syriza's collapse in the face of the EU onslaught. Trajectory of that is what is worrying for the establishment in Portugal, because it's not so much that they think that they will be able to successfully challenge the EU and the forces that be. I think what it is that they will successfully be able to destabilize and to try to roll back some of the austerity. Whether they could do that, I'm very, very skeptical.
I just, before we go to Mark, I'll just say that actually you would take some argument from me on that point about Syriza, you know, being a collapse or some sort of a capitulation. I'm just going to very briefly describe it from this perspective for me. I spent most of my professional life at the closing table doing real estate transactions, and not just, I've done tens of thousands of house closings, literally, but also, you know, somebody's buying a block in Manhattan and doing like a sale lease back, you know, all kinds of complicated leasehold financing, whatever, drafting the documents, and sometimes out of whole cloth and all of that. So I've spent a lot of time at the negotiating table. When I was watching Syriza negotiate, and what I saw at the conclusion, I was very impressed from that perspective, and particularly that these were people that call themselves and, you know, ideologically present themselves as being on the left. They were very, very competent considering what they had, what they walked into the room with. And the game isn't over. They've just positioned themselves for the next battle, and they stayed in power long enough for the upcoming Spanish election and for, you know, what's happening in Portugal. Obviously, they were successful in not discrediting, standing up against austerity, because Portuguese people felt free to go and vote that way.
Yeah, I don't agree with that analysis, but maybe Mark does. I'm not sure.
All right, well, I'll go off on my own take. I'm going to go all lefty here, and I think we're completely understating what is going on. This, after 41 years, in 1974, Portugal finally overthrew an authoritarian past.
Fascist.
And fascist past, yeah. Let's call it what it was, fascist, and became a democracy. 41 years later, this week, that ended. Democracy has been abolished in Portugal by any meaningful sense of the word. When the results don't go in line with the neoliberal EU and the financial interests that it represents, it is simply ignored and overruled. And I think, I hope the Portuguese people come out into the streets and begin a new revolution, because that's what's necessary at this point. And we're not just seeing...
You get no disagreement from me.
Yeah, this is a reaction to austerity, which is a symptom of the greater democracy deficit,
right,
and neoliberal nature of the EU. Again, most people have matched the EU with its rhetoric, but you know, any organization that makes you vote again and again until you say yes, give the right answer,
right,
or ignores you when you give the wrong answer, you know. This isn't a democratic organization. This is a postmodern neoliberal death trap of nations. Yeah. We have seen what has happened in Portugal repeated already. In Italy, we have seen this. We haven't had a real democratically elected government in Italy for years now, several years. You know, and the Italians, you know, of course, the Italians I know have complained about this, but they are living in a EU troika dictated authoritarian system. Yeah, technocracy at this point. It is a neoliberal technocracy. Greece, we had the same thing happen before the election of Syriza, where they had a caretaker government approved by the troika installed. It failed. That led to the election of Syriza, which then failed the people who elected it. And, you know, we're back to, you know, complete paralysis in the government there. But again, at the end of the day, the troika dictates, you know, no matter who is elected, what will happen there. So across the pigs, we see this happening now. The disattention this is getting from the mainstream, the Western press, that cries about installing democracy around the world and supports every crusade to toss over a dictator and everything, is damning. Because this is in their own countries, we see the results of democracy just completely ignored and overruled when it doesn't give the right answers that suit the banks and the financial interests.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, to his credit, Ambrose Evans Pritchard wrote a pretty good piece on what happened in Portugal.
In the Telegraph.
And he was one of the only people who I think really did a fine job of reporting the entire course of what happened in Greece and with Syriza. And Mark is absolutely right on all counts. And I would remind people too that you know, it's interesting that we're talking about Portugal and Lisbon, because the Lisbon Treaty was in fact one of the prime examples of the anti-democratic nature of the European Union. I believe it was Ireland and possibly one or two other countries that on multiple occasions voted against that treaty and were forced almost at gunpoint to continue to vote until they voted the right way.
Actually, both France and the Netherlands voted in a referendum against an EU constitution, and it was ignored, and it was declared that we will never have referendums in any country that we don't have to, except for Ireland, which mandated it by their constitution. Again, Ireland had to have one. And then when they gave the wrong answer, they were made to vote again until they gave the right answer.
Exactly.
Until they gave the right answer.
You know, and I think that this is Yanis Varoufakis talked about this extensively. It's part of the reason why he resigned from the Syriza government, that when he went into the negotiating room, he went with concrete proposals and he wanted to essentially speak to a more, let's call it, democratized European Union, European space. And he was basically stonewalled to the point where now when he speaks about it publicly, he talks about the EU in much the same terms as one would talk about a dictatorship. In other words, there is no democracy. It is the diktats of the financial establishment and the established parties and those who control the European Union. And I think that what we're seeing in Portugal is just a prime example of that. It's and Greece, like I said, it's a negative example, I think, in a lot of ways, because quite frankly, it shows not only what the left is unable to achieve. I think that might be a little bit unfair. I think it shows the incredible odds that are stacked against any government that seeks to challenge the financial authorities in Brussels, in Berlin, in Frankfurt, in London, and all of these other places.
I think what it shows is, in relief, in sharp relief. And I think, for example, this point was driven home by the referendum in Greece and what Varoufakis tells about his experience trying to negotiate an actual deal. It shows the relative power of forces and where things at, where power rests. And it also shows, though, again, it's in relief. You can see where our strengths are, what tactics and what tools they have, many available on the other side to, you know, to stop this attempt to, you know, change the nature of the economic relations in Europe, so that you get rid of this neoliberal model, you get rid of austerity, right. You start trying to invest and trying to grow the economy. You know, I mean, he had Keynes with him, Keynes' son with him at the, you know, at the big public event that he did in Europe, just to drive the point home that, hey, look, there are a lot of alternatives within the model that lets you guys all make money that can work for everybody else too, if you just, you know, are willing to listen. That's how much of a concession they started with ideologically, and he showed exactly how intransigent the other side is.
But it's not just intransigent. It exposed the complete and utter facade of democracy.
Oh, for sure.
And that's what Portugal is demonstrating. That's what Varoufakis has talked about,
what
we saw in Greece.
Yeah.
There is no democracy in the European Union. It is a financial dictatorship.
And the re-election of Syriza.
There are two sides to this, because we can talk about the imposition of neoliberalism on one hand as a left issue, but we should also address where the left can find a lot of common ground with the right, which is the EU's erosion of sovereignty, which, of course, goes right along with it.
Right.
And I mean, we can take a look at the government in Hungary, and a lot of leftists will rightly have a lot of problems with some of the positions of the government in Hungary.
Yeah.
But the Hungary, you know, Orbán has been very strong in trying to crawl back a little bit of their sovereignty from the EU, and they're one wrong step away from an EU-sponsored coup.
Yeah.
They're very unhappy with this. You know, democracy can't be allowed if the results of democracy are illiberal, just
right.
like if they're leftist.
Right.
And we see this even more particularly in the case of Ukraine. The government of Viktor Yanukovych supported an EU association agreement up until the last minute. He campaigned for it personally and changed the viewpoint of a considerable part of the country, which had previously been divided about 50-50 around. But at the very end, they were basically handed a 1,600-plus page diktat with no room for negotiation, and it was a neoliberal diktat, and they weren't given the billions they would need to enact this without, you know, having mass social problems and unrest in the country as a result of this. And they were forced to say no. And they went in the Russian direction and accepted a $15 billion loan and so on. This led to the EU's open support of the Maidan riots and putsch, you know, essentially when a government dared say no to them.
Right.
This is, again, the question of democracy, right? There was no democratic vote to remove the Ukrainian president. There was scheduled to be an election just a year later. Yanukovych probably would have lost anyway, but he wouldn't have lost under such conditions that allowed them to completely pogrom, lustrate, and ban all political opposition from the eastern half of the country,
right.
so that they could refashion the Ukraine along with the interests not only of the local regime, but of their EU and U.S. masters.
Yes. Two points to add to that as well, too. Mark is absolutely correct to point to that. And also, I would just add a little caveat or clarification that it's not just political purges and lustration of the eastern part of the country. The National Communist Party, which was one of the most powerful historically as well as in contemporary times, political parties had tremendous support. Not just in the East, all throughout the country.
Yep.
The Communist Party in Lviv was absolutely decimated. It was one of the first targets of the political persecution and repression, as well as the Party of Regions all throughout the country, which was Yanukovych's party. So, yes, of course, in the eastern part of the country, but really throughout the country. Now, I want to also
There were three leftist parties banned.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, now they're eating themselves.
There was a pro-EU socialist party that was banned as well.
Yeah, but now they're eating each other. I mean, they're so hungry that they've, you know, they, once they've devoured everyone else, they're looking at each other.
Let's hold off on that because I just want to add to what Mark was saying. There is another example here with regard to sovereignty and with regard to democracy in terms of what the EU has done. Remember the third energy package and the energy and the politics mm-hmm. around these pipeline issues and the energy issues and the Europeans trying to move away from Russia and dependence on Russian gas. Remember how many times various countries in the Balkans and Southern Europe, whether the South Stream pipeline or others, that they wanted to be able to make deals with Russians that would benefit their own people because they could get the cheapest gas, because they could establish the best rates and so forth. And the European Union basically said, you can make deals with anyone you want, except, of course, if it's the Russians, and then we'll say no, and you're not allowed to do that. In other words, these countries are supposed to be able to dictate their own economic policies and politics when it comes to not necessarily matters of monetary policy, I think that's a given, but matters of fiscal policy and energy and trade and things like that are theoretically in the hands of sovereign nations in the European space. But the example of Russian energy, I think, really explodes that mythology. So on the political side, there is no democracy, as we see with Portugal, as we saw with Greece. On the economic side, we can see clearly and unmistakably a complete lack of democracy and sovereignty.
Well, again, the hypocrisy of the energy package goes even a step further, because while Brussels and particularly Germany and others put down the hammer on Bulgaria, Greece, any of the countries, Serbia, which is a prospective EU member, that were willing to agree to this South Stream or the then Turk Stream that would have met their energy needs, they were hammered. They were hammered on this by Brussels, by Merkel. And then when these options are gone, we have the Germans agree to a backdoor deal for a second Nord Stream to meet their energy demands. Yeah. If I was the southern, south, and eastern countries of the EU, I would be like, I want out of this crazy place.
Well, because if you take that a step further, they'll end up reselling the oil to Bulgaria ultimately and charging a fee, of course.
Absolutely, and the middleman fees and Bulgaria again won't control it. So we'll have another link between them and Russia rather than dealing with them directly and getting energy piped right into their own country. So again, another restriction on their sovereignty.
Well, and that goes back to what Mark said a few minutes ago. And just as a disclaimer, I make no positive or affirmative statements with regard to Hungary and Orbán. And they're courting of fascists and their policy with regard to migrants and all of that. I'm not condoning any of that. However, this question of pipelines, question of pipelines and energy, Orbán made a in many ways pretty courageous move in signing a pipeline deal, an energy supply deal with the Russians in the face of all of this. And I think that that in many ways demonstrates a lot of this disconnect between what we might call, say, the moderate left and the moderate right, in other words, the neoliberal center on both sides of the political spectrum, and the, let's call it, the far left and the far right, in terms of sovereignty, in terms of wanting to be able to make their own decisions on a national level. And Orbán and his far right government in Hungary have done that. Now, they've done a lot of bad things too. Let me go on that point.
Yeah, I think it is. On that, it's interesting because you have this contradiction replicated throughout that part of Europe, for example, and many other places like Latin America, where you have these contradictory conditions where, on the one hand, traditionally or recent history or developing, there's a control of the local everything, political economy, raw finance, everything. Like historically, Latin America by the United States, and say the EU in parts of Eastern Europe, either in the process of constructing or having a 20-year history. And the local governments that try to rally whatever forces there are in the country to try to protect the sovereignty and to further develop the sovereignty of the country find very often at the polls is where their support lies. You have what you're describing in Hungary, for example, and you have the anti-austerity movement across Europe that combines the, you know, the left, or they call the far left politically, the left outside the Social Democrats, and the far right. And what it does do, if I wouldn't want to have to walk on that, you know, to try to balance myself on it, but what it does do, if you can assemble it, you actually can stand up to the EU or the United States or whatever, and you're seeing, like, the allowance for a multiplicity of political forms in Latin America as they reach regional integration, kind of that same kind of marriage. You know, you have, like, Colombia may end up being allied with Venezuela as against the United States.
Yeah, I want to touch on that. I think this is a really important, it's not just a trend, it is a necessity for politics going forward when we're dealing with hegemonic structures like the EU, you know, the world financial architecture and so forth. They have triangulated politics to the center. So that both parties in most countries, the right hand, the left hand, you know, the liberals, the conservatives, right, left, have failed, have ceased having any distinction, right? We're one neoliberal duopoly of power in many countries.
Social policy US, or some other symbolic break is what they fight.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we have little you know, culture wars and so on. But you know, economically, foreign policy, the parties are the same, right? We're just rotating different elites at this point. What this has done is this has caused, particularly in Europe at this point, although we see a little bit of this trend in the United States, is voters starting to drift towards far left and I would call alternative right populist parties, looking for any alternative to this neoliberal triangulated consensus. I think we'll all agree here that there are definitely some right forces in Europe that, you know, we just can't touch. And I would single out the Golden Dawn in particular as one such. But I think the left really needs to start, you know, doesn't have to be cooperation, but some type of coordination with right parties, particularly like Le Pen's party in France, who, while we do have the left does have you know, legitimate social disagreements with, I don't think that these are as important at this point, particularly when parties like Le Pen have such really leftish economic packages. All right, well, they're not communists, they're not Trotskyists, right, so on, but we have far more in common with them than you know, they do with the economic patches of the centrist parties. Right. And this, if right and left parties are going to do anything to dislodge this neoliberal technocratic hegemonic control of governments in the EU and elsewhere, they really need to start finding where they can agree, right and left, on either side, because there's no other way, you know, that it can happen.
They called it United Front when the left allied with the liberal bourgeoisie to fight fascism. They called it a United Front strategy here and across Europe, and it arises out of a similar need.
I think that there's I agree, theoretically. I think that there's a couple of finer points that need to be added, though. Unfortunately, what you see, rather than the let's call them right wing realist, right wing, you know, populist, whatever formations, really moving, trying to court left wing formations in the creation of a united front, rather than that, you see much more courting of the extreme right, and that's the problem, and that's the danger here. Because it's not just Golden Dawn. You have various Nazi and neo-Nazi parties. I mean, Ukraine is an obvious example, but you see it in Greece, you see it in Hungary, you see it in some of the Scandinavian countries as well, even to various countries on the European, let's call it the European heartland, you see the same thing. And the problem here is that when you are unable to separate, let's call it the good right from the bad right, what happens is then that the populist right moves further to the right. And that's the danger here because on the one hand, yes, of course, I think anybody could agree that some kind of a united front strategy is important. At the same time, if you, you know, I interviewed Yanis Varoufakis like 3 years ago, and he told me an interesting story about driving in Athens and turning on the radio, talk radio in Athens, and hearing somebody speaking about economic policy, and he didn't know who they were, and he found himself agreeing with a lot of what they were saying. Like probably he said like 75% of what they were saying was pretty sound and accurate. And then at the end of the interview, he finds out that this was a major leader in the Golden Dawn.
Right.
And this is the danger here is well, because look, the rhetoric of populism, economic populism, and anti-EU positions from fascist formations allows them to then pull the mainline right-wing parties further to the right. And so there is a sort of a push and pull happening here. And while I understand what Mark is saying, I'm a little bit more skeptical about what Le Pen's actual policies in power would be versus what her rhetoric is in running for office. I mean, she talks about leaving NATO. Do I really believe that Le Pen would lead France out of NATO? I'm skeptical. But
let me make a point about this because I understand it. You can make a million examples of that. But let's say that Le Pen gets elected on an anti-NATO platform. And then betrays
the... Would she be allowed to take office?
There's that question too, Mark. Yeah, right. I got you. No, let me finish the thought.
Platform. It'll be an anti-immigrant platform. Yeah, that'll be the center.
That'll be the center of it, right. And she'll deliver on that to the extent possible and keep tension in the society to the extent possible as well so she can keep milking it. But there's also going to be a part of the constituency that the reason that they're floating it as a demand is that there is a constituency for it that they're recruiting. And when they don't deliver on that, that constituency is available to the other side. And that's my point.
No, but there in France, there is no other side. What other side?
Well, in France, you'll need a left. I mean, they're on the ground there. There just isn't a national voice of any consequence.
I don't know. I can't really speak to that.
Yeah, there's a lot of small Trotskyists, you know, in other parties that Don is right. They don't have any meaningful power in politics to affect change. Le Pen is, I wouldn't agree with her on everything, but Le Pen is a case where I can swallow my disagreements, and in the cause of giving her a chance, I would support Le Pen in France because she is possible if, you know, she was actually allowed to assume office, or the results were just ignored, like they were with Portugal. Yeah. As the same way, I would support Jeremy Corbyn in the United Kingdom.
And you know, there's a longer game here too that I'm trying to get to, and that is that in the event that you have, essentially the neoliberal model is collapsing of its own weight. You know, it's eating itself to the point of starvation. And at the same time, it keeps trying to suck and suck more blood to sustain itself. That's all this austerity stuff, all these other different things. They're trying to get the last drops of blood. If a coalition of the left and right that is anti-austerity, if that's the symbol of it, or anti-neoliberal, is able to stand long enough to starve that thing, it'll come down. And then the game is the next step, who's positioned for what. And that's what I think we have that's where you have to do your decision making is, if this happens, where are we and where is the right?
Yeah, there are no easy answers. I don't have a plan or a framework to put forward, and I have reservations about the right, just as I have some reservations, about the far left on some social issues like the LGBT agenda and so on. But I know that compromises have to be made, and it is the only real way forward. And you know, unless we want another 100 years of neoliberal dictatorship in the EU and in other countries.
Well, let me propose something here. here, and I mean, I'm not proposing it necessarily as a cohesive or coherent action plan, but I've spoken to people who are in Germany and who are on the left in Germany. And what I hear is that, and I'm not talking necessarily just about, you know, Die Linke, which is more or less social democratic left, you know, left of center party, but the, let's call it the harder left, the communist left, if you will, in Germany. And that is fracturing. It is splitting basically down the middle. You have on the one hand the so-called communists who are basically supporters of the EU, supporters of NATO, supporters of humanitarian imperialism, supporters of all of these policies. Yeah. And then you have the other left, which they like to smear as the Stalinist left, which is more or less anti-EU, anti-austerity, pro-Russian, and so forth. And you see a similar split on the left in the U.S. You see a similar split on the left in various other places. Now, if this split were to deepen and you could really divide the left along communist lines or whatever, but along anti-imperialist lines, along anti-EU lines, that split on the left is now meaningful. And if you can create a similar split on the right along different lines, because they're all pretty much anti-EU, anti-NATO, more or less. I mean, not all, but many of them are. You have to have a different kind of a divide emerge on the right. And I would say it needs to be an anti-fascist divide that splits the right into those who are pro-fascist and those who reject fascism in various forms. Now you take those remnants, the anti-imperialist left and the anti-fascist right, you bring those together, now you have something meaningful and something that could actually work.
I wonder what the numbers
are. It has to be formulated on this anti-neoliberal, anti-hegemonic, anti-imperialism concept, because that is the common ground here. And I would suggest, actually, if we take a look at it, we are actually a step forward in a dialogue on this type of issue, because Eric is as left and progressive, as hard left and progressive, straight across the board as they come. And while
not straight across the board, there are exceptions. Okay. But yes.
there are some exceptions. We're complicated people. We're not restricted. We're not restricted by dogma, right? But at the same time, while I have statist, very leftish positions on economic issues, on social issues, I find a lot of common ground with the right, with religious opinion, and so on, and we're able to find great common ground on things that we find the most important because of our prioritization, and I think this conversation between the three of us here is a vision of the dialogue that needs to begin on the alt-right and the far left on way to move forward. So cheers to us.
And you won't get that on CNN, folks.
Community Public Radio, forming the coalition that will change the world.
We hope so. We're doing our best this time. So let's skate around the map a little bit. Maybe we could talk, maybe update a little what's been happening in Syria.
Sure. Mark?
Me? Yeah. Okay. So, Syria. What is happening on the ground right now is we see slow but hard progress by the Syrian Arab Army, the NDF, supported by some Iranian Quds forces, whether they're just advisors or we see some more actual troops there in Hezbollah, particularly in the area around Aleppo, Homs, Latakia. We see some slow slogging progress. We've seen several dozen villages change hands so far under the support of Russian airstrikes and intelligence coordination. This is positive, but the problem right now is that the jihadist forces, we call them the moderate terrorists or rebels are being flooded with tow weapons.
Yep.
And these are advanced anti-tank weapons produced by the United States that are handed off to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia ordered tens of thousands of them last year. Then they are turned right around and given to, you know, the various Islamist and jihadist groups that Saudi Arabia supports in Syria. And this has to be done with the explicit permission of the United States because of end users agreements.
Right. Yep.
So whatever the U.S. says to the contrary, the U.S. taxpayer is right now supporting jihadists in Syria, right, with advanced anti-tank weapons that are taking their toll. And if we see man pads, we've already seen a few of them early on in the conflict, but if we see man pads capable of taking down Russian helicopters at the least, maybe some low fighting aircraft doing close air support, we know where those are coming from as well. And I don't see any signs of real de-escalation. Despite, you know, having come finally to a bare minimum of a deconfliction agreement between Russia and the United States, things are looking very bad. The one positive sign, which I'm still skeptical about, is that Jordan evidently has agreed to coordinate intelligence with Russia. And this is a little interesting because Jordan is a client state of the United States, you know, in every shape.
It's been a training and staging area for a lot of the terrorists that are in Syria.
Absolutely. At least 10,000 CIA-trained proxies, they were trained in Jordan, right? They're equipped in Jordan. They go to Jordan to centers that are, the acronym is actually MOM, to get their paychecks and take their R&R. So this is interesting. I want to see where this goes, whether this is a sea change or whether this has any meaning. On the other hand, we have Qatar threatened to go to war with Russia, right? Because that's what they did. They threatened direct military action, knowing that Russia is directly involved in the country. And I have, you know, Qatar got a little bit too big with their britches already in Libya. A couple years ago, they openly beat up a Russian diplomat in Qatar. You know, I have to, are the Qataris suicidal? I mean, do they want Qatar to be turned into a big glass parking lot by Russian nuclear weapons?
I think that there's well, I think that they maybe are overestimating the power of their Al Jazeera propaganda. But I think that there's a number of points to make. I agree with everything Mark said. I'm not going to reiterate all of his points, other than to say a couple of things. There is cause to really wonder about this Russian-Jordan arrangement here because we're skeptical on the one hand, but it would make sense in a practical sense because there were reports about 3 weeks ago, more or less, when the Russian campaign was really getting going here, that some of these Islamic State forces were filtering into Jordan. Now, when we say Islamic State forces, we're more or less talking about those forces, not that were trained in Jordan, which are the quote-unquote relatively moderate rebels, Al-Qaeda and others, but you're talking about some of these hardened Islamic State fighters who up until that point had been pretty much in Syria for the last 2 years or so. They were filtering into Jordan. Now, there is obviously a very real danger for the regime in Jordan that it could actually destabilize the entire country, and it could really cause a problem for the Jordanian government. And so I on the one hand am skeptical. On the other hand, I could believe it in the sense that the Jordanian government is trying to hedge their bets against this Frankenstein's monster that they've been instrumental in unleashing. So I think that that's something really that needs to be watched. I want to point to something else, though, in regard to a lot of these issues. Very interesting story came out of Turkey, I think this week, in which two of the major opposition leaders had a press conference in which they announced publicly that the government in Turkey is deliberately undermining and suppressing investigations by its own government-appointed prosecutors in a couple of different cities in Turkey who have now revealed that they have hard evidence. Proof that the Turks supplied the sarin gas that was used by the terrorists in Syria in August of 2013. Wow. Now, this is a very interesting story because, of course, we remember that the United States almost went to war in Syria over the chemical weapons attack in August of 2013. This was debunked by many different sources. It came out. Seymour Hersh was one of the instrumental journalists
They blamed it on the Syrian government.
They blamed it on the Syrian government when Seymour Hersh brought out the evidence from his network of sources that, in fact, Turkey was probably the supplier of that. Now that evidence has come out, is out in the open, and the Turkish government is literally on a crusade to quash any of this information from coming out. Now, this is in keeping with this other development that's come out in Turkish courts and in Turkish media, that the government and its intelligence forces, the MIT, have now directly been implicated in alliance and coordination and support for the Islamic State. Not al-Nusra Front, not moderate rebels, not Ahrar al-Sham, ISIS, ISIL, the Islamic State in Syria. Now, these two things taken together, I think, illustrate both the insidious role of Turkey, but also now what is unmistakably a very precarious situation for Erdogan and his government. And we need to watch how that's going to play out in light of this attack on the Kurds, the peace march, in light of all of these other issues that are coming to the fore. Both Jordan and Turkey have the very real potential of destabilization because of their actions in Syria.
Yeah, and Lebanon. Lebanon is the other one, of course.
But Lebanon is a slightly different case for a number of other reasons.
Yeah, those are the three destabilization, the big threats. And, Turkey could very easily devolve, if not into a complete civil war, then to a civil conflict here, I agree. But we have to remember, we can blame Erdogan and we can point, I don't think any of us here doubted any of these facts. They're just further confirmation, to the role Turkey has played in this all along. But Turkey, has just been playing the hostie ground for the United States and the United Kingdom and all
of
this.
Oh, of course, yes, absolutely. And that's the unsaid part, yes.
We cannot forget that Turkey is a NATO member.
Exactly.
And you would have to be completely naive a fool to think that this isn't all being done without U.S. Permission, without U.S. support, and of course without Saudi financing.
Mark, the terrorist base in Adana, the city of Adana in Turkey, is literally a 20-minute drive from NATO's principal base at Incirlik.
There we go. Turkey all along has been, I've heard it described as a Disneyland for terrorists, and that's what it is. They come to Turkey as their stopping off and stepping off point when they need a little R&R, when they need their weapons when they need their paychecks given to them by, whether it's the West or the GCC providing their paychecks, just as Jordan is fulfilling the same role in the south of Syria for the Southern Front.
Let me bring in one last thing, because I know we're about to run out of time here, but Benghazi, Clinton scandal and Benghazi, the unsaid aspect of the Benghazi issue is that they were funneling their terrorists out of Libya into Syria via the CIA facility at Benghazi. And where were they going? Iskenderun, Turkey.
Hey, did you catch my newscast yesterday, you guys?
Huge cargoes of weapons, weapons supplied by the West to Libya, to accompany those fighters then into Syria as well. So both the fighters and the weapons.
Right. Yeah, we covered there was one Republican member of Congress from Illinois who asked Hillary Clinton if at these hearings, if we came, they saw he died, was the U.S. policy. And her reply was more interesting than the fact that the question was asked. And he pursued this whole line that basically said, you know, the crime isn't necessarily Benghazi. The crime was what you did to Libya.
Oh, well, that is the only person that has pointed out, after months of this Benghazi nonsense, what the real crime and the real issue of all of this was. No one cares about Clinton's emails, servers, you know, the story of this ambassador, whom we all know is the CIA there.
Of course.
But the question is, what was done to Libya? A side note, while we're closing, for those of you who didn't hear her, check out Tulsi Gabbard, Democratic representative from Hawaii, who was on CNN with Wolf Blitzer. She's a veteran, a Marine veteran, and a surfer. Beautiful, intelligent, well-spoken. She laid the line on Syria, exactly what's going out to Wolf Blitzer, and floored him. Watch the video, everyone.
And please, let me just add one last point here. One other thing that does not come out in those Benghazi hearings, because neither side wants it to come out, is the fact that Benghazi illustrates exactly what the U.S. policy still is in Syria today. Because remember that the Benghazi incident was the outgrowth of terrorists who were on the CIA payroll, who had been supposedly providing security, then being part of an assault on this facility. So it demonstrates the U.S. complicity in funding and arming terrorists in Libya, using them for their agenda in that country and in Syria. In many ways, Benghazi is almost like a microcosm for U.S. policy in both of those countries.
You know,
it's a precursor. It just illustrates the bankruptcy and the inevitable backlash.
Let me just also pose a question that we don't have time to answer today, but for people to think about. Given the way that the U.S. government breaks down along factions within itself, you know, the state and the deep state and the components of that, is it possible that some elements within the U.S. government had those al-Qaeda or whoever people kill the ambassador in order to bring Hillary Clinton in front of this committee?
I'm not going there.
I would say I wouldn't pose that theory because it's impossible. But I would say there's a very real possibility that they were trying to liquidate a lot of evidence of what they had been doing. That's also very possible.
Yeah, because that whatever happened in the that existed in the memory of the ambassador is gone with.
Well, he was coordinating the terrorist effort in Libya and then in Syria. And you had all the paperwork, all of the evidence. It was all sitting right there. So, yeah, it's very easily believable that they tried to liquidate the Benghazi facility and cover up everything that had been done.
I had filet mignon five times.
Patrice's mistress also mentioned that beneath the embassy was being used as a torture chamber by the CIA.
Right. I had filet mignon five different occasions in the very hotel that ambassador was conducting the operations from a year or two before they invaded, at the Corinth Hotel in Tripoli. Nice place it was before they blew it up.
Prepare yourself for hate mail from vegetarians.
Okay, folks, thanks a lot. This was a pleasure, and looking forward to it again next week.
As always. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys. You've been listening to CPR Sundays with Eric Dreitzer and Mark Sloboda. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.